On this episode of the London Lyceum, we talk with Dr. Jonathan Beakey about the duplex Regnum Christi and two kingdom theology. So we cover all sorts of topics like just what in the world is that duplex Regnum? What did the early magisterial reformers think about it? Did they have any shared understanding potentially of a two kingdoms theology or political theology in general? How did this contrast with the patristic and medieval thinkers? Did they influence the reformers in any particular way? Did Luther and Calvin think differently about this? Were they similar in any ways? How about the Reformed Orthodox? How about the views of Leiden, Geneva, Edinburgh? How might the reformers' views be similar to something like Van Drunen's approach or Christian nationalist approach or even neo-Calvinism and transformationalism? And much, much more. As always, if you have thoughts about the episode or ideas or requests for the show in general, hit us up on Twitter or Facebook or check us out at our website, thelondonlyceum.com. Now, for the only analytic, Baptist, and confessional podcast on the planet, we think this one's going to get you thinking.
Well, I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of The London Lyceum. I'm one of your hosts, Jordan Stefaniak. And our podcast is dedicated to serious thinking for a serious church. We think the church in today's age needs serious answers, which requires a sort of intellectual culture that we've tried to hopefully encourage with things like charity, curiosity, critical thinking, and cheerful confessionalism. So we don't think that the questions that we're facing today only need precise answers. They also need sort of virtuous dispositions in how we present it, how we think about it, how we treat others. So hopefully, part of what we've tried to do with the podcast is to promote those things. So when we interview people, you'll hear people all across the spectrum, which is both fun for me and I think helpful for you guys to listen, to be able to experience firsthand what other people say. In today's episode, though, this is going to be more historical in nature, so it's just going to be a lot of fun. I get to ask lots of questions, and I don't have to feel bad about asking things because we're talking about people who are long gone now, so there's not as much pressure or tension when you ask things. So this is going to be awesome. If you guys don't know Dr. Jonathan Beakey, you should. He's at Puritan Reformed Theological Seminary, and he's awesome. So he's got the right blend, in my mind, of the pastoral passion and vocation and the sort of like just approach to how you think about theology built in with the academic stuff. We love to do both sides. So we'll interview pastors, we'll interview academics, but the people who kind of like blend both, I just love to promote them. So Dr. Beakey's awesome in a lot of ways. We're going to talk about what was originally the dissertation, was also a Brill book. So if your library has access to Brill, make sure they get a copy of this on the Duplex Regnum Christi, the twofold kingdom in Reformed theology. So before we get into it, Dr. Beakey, just give me, I don't know, a 60-second, like, what do you do? What do you like to teach? Those sort of things. Maybe what was it that drew you to this topic in particular for your dissertation?
Yeah, thank you, Jordan. And thanks so much for having me on your show. It's a real pleasure for me. I'm glad I could join you. So, yeah, 60, you're going to keep me to 60 seconds. That's good. I grew up in Canada. In fact, I'm Canadian, so I naturally like hockey and coffee. My Toronto Maple Leafs, they're hanging on there, very, very close. But what drew me to this topic is I went to my undergrad to Redeemer University College, and that's kind of a neo-Calvinist, transformationalist type of school. In fact, I had a number of classes by Dr. Al Walters, who wrote Creation Regained. And then after that, I went to seminary in Westminster Seminary, California, where Dr. Van Drunen for a number of classes. So I really got a very different perspective from there, and really respected both men, very godly men. But both claiming Reformation sources for their views, and so that really got me thinking and really interested in this particular topic, and really wanted to do. I loved historical theology, and so that's kind of what forced me into this study. Ended up at Westminster Seminary in Philly, did coursework there, but then transferred to a Dutch university and finished a PhD there.
Awesome.
I'm married. I have four kids. I'm an elder at an OPC church here locally. I teach historical theology at Puritan Reformed, as you say, and I'm the academic dean here now. So, yeah.
Very awesome. So I didn't know the connections to Van Drunen and to Redeemer. So this is, I've even got more questions now. This is going to be a lot of fun. I feel like everybody's interested in this topic now. So this should be, I'm sure we'll get a lot of questions about it. So let's just start, set the table. When we talk about the duplex regnum, Christy, like what in the world does that mean? And so just give me like that basic sort of definition.
Yep. Yeah. So it's a fancy Latin title, right? Duplex Regnum Christi, literally meaning the twofold kingdom of Christ. And this is technically a distinction from the Reformed Orthodox period, where it talks about where they spoke of a distinction in the kingdom of Christ, how Christ rules, how Christ reigns. And they had lots of different labels for this, but the most common labels would be to distinguish between the essential kingship of Christ versus the mediatorial kingship of Christ. And any time that they spoke of, or at any time that the scriptures speak of a kingdom or power or authority that's transferred from the Father to the Son, that rose questions. Like, what does that mean? Does the Son not have power, authority to himself? Is this, you know, what does that mean? So the Reformed Orthodox then distinguished between that authority and power that is natural, essential to the Son. It's of his own right, and that's appropriate to the Logos, to the second person of the Trinity. But then they spoke also of this mediatorial power and authority that he exercises as the God-man. And this is a power and authority that's received from the Father to the God-man. And he exercises that on behalf of the church and for his people.
Okay, so as I think about that distinction, it's helpful. I want to think historically, you know, you mentioned how this is kind of developing Reformed Orthodox period. As we think about precursors to this versus what they're developing here, is there any overlap or similarity? Are there things that are latent in earlier reformers like Calvin and others that are kind of pointing in this direction? Or is this sort of an original outworking of the Reformed Orthodox period and their context?
Yeah, good. Yeah, really, really my dissertation is an argument of unity and discontinuity. It really builds off of, you shouldn't say this, but the Muller thesis, right? Of that there is this unity and discontinuity. So the discontinuity is in the specific terminology, the terms of the duplex regnum, you know, the regnum essentiale, regnum mediatorium, or the essential kingdom, the mediatorial kingdom. But certainly it builds off of many earlier reformers, you know, the even early church figures like Augustine, his two cities, even medieval figures. I'm thinking of Thomas, who wrote a very unique work his unique work. So yes, it's certainly building off of earlier figures, and of course Luther and his two kingdom doctrine, and that's articulated also by Calvin as well. So yes, it's definitely building on all of these other figures, but then having its own distinct identity. And I think the one thing that's interesting to me is as the Reformed Orthodox appropriate this from earlier figures, they locate it much more connected to Christology, to who Christ is, the rule and reign of Jesus Christ. And whereas in earlier reformers, the discussion is much more in ecclesiology and the church and the church as distinct from, let's say, the magistrate or things like that. So I find it interesting where the discussion resides in their systematic theologies. So you see this movement. And then another interesting thing that I found is in response to why. So what stimulated this further development or this refinement of their theology and their distinctions? And I found it to be not so much driven by politics, but by more exegetical concerns. And they were forced that way by heretical positions. So both polemical and exegetical reasons why they were sort of forced to really refine their distinctions. Those are some interesting things that I've argued in my dissertation.
Yeah, so that's helpful. So before I want to look specifically at the Reformed Orthodox, I see claims quite often of like just this, and you mentioned Muller, this unity and diversity, so I imagine that's the direction you would go with it, but almost like the magisterial Protestants all have this same political theology, this same vision of two kingdoms. And the way that I see it online and other popular level publications is there's just like this one view. That doesn't seem to be what you're saying. So maybe just tell, like, what are the continuities and discontinuities, the main ones that you would say across this broad reform period that you would say, this is the stuff that stays the same. This is the stuff that changes and develops.
Yeah, that's good. Just to echo that, that's it seems to be the very common perception that there's this one monolithic view that holds fast throughout all periods, and that's just blatantly false, right? I mean, history is often messier than we perceive it to be. So my goal essentially was to try to understand the uniqueness and development of this doctrine. It did not flatline. It did not stay the same, you know, from, let's say, a Luther on, and everybody is cast in the image of Luther, or everybody is cast in the image of Calvin. So one thing, and again, what things sort of differed in terms of discontinuity? Well, a big thing that I focus on is terminology. So Luther, for example, spoke of a plurality of often in terms of two kingdoms. You don't see that language of plurality in Calvin, for example. Calvin actually had a singular focus on his terminology. He did not speak of two kingdoms in the plural, but most often, if not always, I think there might have been a couple cases that I found where he spoke of plurality, but generally speaking, he spoke of a twofold kingdom, which isn't in terms of contemporary language, it's not as attractive. It doesn't have that same flair to it as, you know, two kingdom theology or two kingdom distinction. So Calvin himself spoke of a twofold kingdom, but then Calvin did speak of, in terms of spiritual or civil kingdom, that was his language, which was not the language of later Reformed Orthodox figures, which, as I said, spoke of more of a mediatorial and essential distinction. So that's one area that I looked at in terms of growth and development. This language moving from Luther to Calvin to the Reformed Orthodox, and even the plurality and different things like that. Other areas would be the verses or the scriptural verses associated with this particular doctrine. One particular verse that I found that popped up time and time and time again was 1 Corinthians 15, 24 to 28, where the Son hands over the kingdom to the Father. What does that mean? And so the Reformed Orthodox later picked up on this distinction of the central verse of the mediatorial as describing that particular verse. You don't find that amongst the magisterial reformers. They're not using 1 Corinthians 15, 24 to 28 to describe their two kingdom distinction or twofold kingdom distinction.
That's helpful. So as I think particularly about the Reformed Orthodox period, who are the main figures developing these ideas and how are they distinguished between each other?
Yeah, good question. So I had to find a way to sort of slice and dissect my analysis because, you can talk about the magisterial reformers, and you're talking, let's say, 60 years. But then when you get to Reformed Orthodoxy, after that, oh boy, that's like another 140 years, right? So how do you sort of select, without being criticized for cherry-picking my particular theologians? So the way that I worked it was I divided my dissertation into two parts. Part one covering the early church and reformational period, and then part two, which would be more of the focus on the Reformed Orthodox, I broke that period into three different schools: Leiden, Geneva, and Edinburgh. And so then I selected representative theologians from each school. And the reason why I found that to be a interesting way to slice history is, number one, my parameters of research were narrowed to those three particular schools. And I picked Leiden, Geneva, and Edinburgh to try to capture different political arrangements or contexts so that I could test my thesis, against these different political contexts and see if there's differences that way. And so, yeah, the two that I picked from Leiden, I selected two from each of those schools. Okay, so I tried to get somebody from more at the earlier side of, Reformed Orthodoxy and some a bit later in terms of their teaching. And the other reason why selecting schools is schools were a dissemination of thought. So if you're looking at the professors who are teaching there, that's a good avenue or window into this intellectual thought that is disseminated throughout Europe. I selected, for Leiden, who I focused on was first and foremost Junius, Francis Junius. He was one figure. And then from Geneva, I focused on Francis Turretin. I've done a fair work on him. And then from Edinburgh, I focused on John Sharp, is sort of a lesser known figure, and then also David Dixon. So, and I'm missing, there were many other figures as well. I mean, Benedict Pictet, there were other figures that I looked at throughout.
I imagine our listeners are probably most familiar with names like Junius or Turretin. So if they're familiar with developments of neo-Calvinism, they start thinking, associating places like Leiden with that eventually. Is there a significant difference between how Junius and Turretin would think about the twofold kingdom and related doctrines? Are they going on different trajectories that ends up leading you to where neo-Calvinism comes and they branch off? Or how should we think about that?
Yeah, a good question. So actually, Junius I found to be a very interesting figure to examine. Junius, argued, was this pivotal figure between the magisterial reformers and the Reformed Orthodox as a whole. Junius, as you said, some of the listeners might be familiar with him for his, he's heralded often as the first to formulate the archetypal-ectypal distinction in his De Vera Theologia, on true theology. So that's an argument that's been made, a very seminal figure in that area. But I've argued that Junius was the first to make this distinction on the Duplex Regnum Christi in terms of a kingdom associated with Jesus Christ, in terms of a personal kingdom, or this essential kingdom versus this mediatorial kingdom. And he makes this, again, this is the first reference that I've ever found to this in 1588 in his Sacred Parallels. This is Yeah, it's a really interesting work where he goes through paralleling Old Testament verses compared to New Testament verses. And so I naturally picked up on the 1 Corinthians 15 passage and looked at that. And that's where I found his first reference to this particular distinction. Another interesting thing about Junius is in his theological theses, he locates it under his theology proper. So, that was not the favored place for other Reformed Orthodox figures. So you asked about distinctions between him and Francis Turretin. Turretin obviously comes later, and it benefits from many other figures. Well, this distinction from Turretin finds itself under the discussion of the munis triplex, the threefold office of Christ, prophet, priest, and king. So it's under his Christology section where he's dealing with this. Whereas Junius, one of the very first to crystallize this distinction, puts it under his theology proper section.
Hey friend, are you a loyal listener to the London Lyceum? If you are, we really appreciate you. But we wanted to make sure you knew about our exclusive content option for the podcast. If you want, for just $5 a month, you can get access to all Kiffin's Keep episodes, Genuinely Particular, Typology by Immersion, and the Hanover House, and any of our other exclusive content that we produce. And all the episodes will be right there in your normal feed. So go ahead and click the link in the show description and you can sign up today. We appreciate you. So, I think all this is super interesting. I do have a question at this point that I want to spend a little bit of time on. David Van Drunen, you mentioned studying, or I guess studying with him, or being at Westminster, California with him.
Yeah.
Is his reception and reading of the Reformed tradition just he's prioritizing different sources? Or would you say that you think there's a misunderstanding of something that's going on somewhere that's causing a different sort of understanding of the two kingdoms?
Yeah, that's a great question. Again, my work remained mostly historical. I tried to maybe hide behind the historical curtain, if you might say, and just try to be as objective as possible and say, here are what these men said and why. What were the intellectual impulses for this? But of course, there was a personal interest that I had myself, having, as I said, studied under Dr. Van Drunen. I've appreciated a lot what David Van Drunen has done in terms of the systematic theology behind the distinctions. But I and again, he's not a historian. Himself, he's more in the systematic theology. So while I've appreciated a lot of what he's done in the systematic theology, I thought that there was the way I could contribute and help the most is in terms of historical theology. And granted, his 2010 work, where he did more of a history, a historical survey, was not comprehensive, and it was it surveyed, it went from Augustine to, what was the latest figure, Van Til or Bart? I can't remember. I mean, it was massive. And so he only had a very small section on the Reformed Orthodox, maybe 40, 50 pages. So if I could fault my mentor or teacher, it would be that there's too flat of a line between that's drawn between Calvin and Luther and the Reformed Orthodox, especially in terms of the labels used, civil kingdom versus spiritual kingdom, things like that. So he's using Calvin's terminology or even Luther's terminology and casting it over all of Reformed Orthodox, period.
Yeah, no, that's very helpful. And clearly, we like David here, so there's no, I don't know what the word is. Sometimes you listen to podcasts and they're just like, let me just trash people. No, we're just trying to like get clear on views,
right?
Treat people with respect and everything. Right. David's written for us at the London Lyceum. You can go check it out. I'll put a link to it. You can read it. His little defense, or I guess he did a critique of theonomy, which, speaking of theonomy, this is not totally related.
but it is in my head related to it. We've had, I don't know, over the last year or two, Stephen Wolf's Christian nationalism has been like everywhere. I don't really care to talk about Stephen's particular view, but he does seem to say that like we should in our current day return back to this magisterial Protestant sort of political theology. I don't know if you've read much of it, but I'm curious, do you think the way he's explaining what the Reformed tradition view is that like, where does that fit? Is he accurately summarizing a segment of the tradition that would fit well with, let's say, if you like his proposal, you should read Junius or you should read Turretin or you should read somebody else? I guess I'm just trying to figure out like what sources is that really drawing from? Because I think he's trying to draw from Turretin quite a bit.
Sure. Yes, he's definitely drawing from the two kingdom distinction. It's interesting. You mentioned I just finished teaching a class on the twofold kingdom of Christ. So this is my first time actually teaching it as a THM PhD course here at Puritan Reformed. And in fact, I was able to get a guest lecture from Dr. Van Druden more towards the beginning of the class, which was really helpful, and the students benefited from that. And then one of the textbooks that I have them read is Stephen Wolf's Christian Nationalism, or the case for that. So, I'm trying to give them different, practical and systematic applications of this particular doctrine. And it's interesting that you can come to and say that you're using this distinction and be based on this Reformed Orthodox distinction and come to very vastly different conclusions like a David Van Druden or a Stephen Wolf. So we had so much fun in class wrestling through all of these issues and these practical systematic applications. I think Stephen Wolf is, I would come to very, very different conclusions than him. I just looked at John Alstead, for example, one figure who wrote, what was this? This was in 1630, he wrote a little treatise, Theological Casuistry, and Alstead himself was immersed in this particular distinction. I give a quote from him in my book where he clearly is working with this mediatorial essential distinction in Christ's rule and reign. And he himself comes to very different conclusions than Wolf in terms of what the Christian magistrate or prince should do and can do. So, there's lots of ways where I would differ from Wolf, practical applications from this distinction.
Yeah. So now as I think about almost the resurgence of Neo-Calvinism, that seems to be, you were at Redeemer University, this transformationalist sort of approach, is that an outgrowth of traditional Reformed thinking, do you think, where it is consistent with thinking about the essential and mediatorial kingship of Christ, or is this totally different?
Yeah, I mean, Van Druden himself makes the case that Kuyper would be within this line, right? Whether you agree with that or not. Later Neo-Calvinism is sort of falls outside of my particular purview. So for me to connect the dots exactly would be hard. And again, Neo-Calvinism itself is a broad camp that has variations within it. So I'm a bit adverse to making big general sweeping statements that this is absolutely connected. So it's kind of hard to say.
Well, that's my favorite thing to do when I talk to historians is make them make the connections they don't want to make.
Right.
So I am interested. So you mentioned early on how one thing you found is the significance of the exegetical reasoning for the conclusions they were coming to. It seems like to me a lot of people who live in our context would probably look back and say, no, that's just the air they breathed, It's probably not exegetical. It's probably cultural. So if they lived today, they would think differently about how to format this. But what you're saying makes me think, no, they're actually making exegetical reasoning. So if they were to live today, would they say, no, we want to reject this form of government. We should endeavor for this vision of church-state relationships. Or how would they, would they reinterpret things?
Yeah, good question. So I'm convinced that, especially the Reformed Orthodox, again, because I see them locating this distinction with under their Christology, that the driving force for them was for protecting the divinity of Christ. And they're doing this within a context of Socinianism, for example, which tried to undermine Christ's divinity. And the Socinians, especially, you know, were pretty astute at using Scripture to buttress their argument that Christ is not divine. And so they would go to texts such as 1 Corinthians 15:24 or Matthew 28, when Jesus says, you know, all authority has been given to me. And they would say, aha, that, you know, there you go. There's evidence that authority, power is not natural to Christ. And so therefore he has to rely on the authority power of the Father. He has to receive it. It's not natural to himself, and so therefore he's not God. He's not divine. And so that's what they're wrestling with. And you see this, you know, whether you're in Leiden, whether in Geneva, whether in Edinburgh, that's the particular context that's sort of forcing this, crystallizing this distinction. It's not so much, now there is a trickle-down effect to, okay, then you have to talk about those who represent that authority, which is representative authorities in the state and in the church. So yes, there is a trickle-down effect to it, but their primary goal was to guard the kingship and authority and the regal power of Christ himself, first and foremost. So I in my conclusion, I talk about this more top-down effect rather than a bottom-up effect, a distinction.
Mm-hmm.
They're more concerned about how Christ rules and reigns rather than trying to locate a particular activity, a cultural activity that we do, and say, okay, where does it fit now?
Yeah.
Does it fit under this authority of Christ, or does it, you know, that's what they're wrestling with.
Yeah, that's helpful. So we haven't spent much time talking about the Edinburgh school. Is that how similar is that to Leiden and Geneva?
Well, the one reason why I picked that particular context is, of course, during the 17th century, that was perhaps the most politically unstable context. You know, you have the whole Covenanter movement there. So it's a very fun context to study. You know, Geneva at that time was much more stable, and so that's why I was able to contrast a more of a stable political context versus Edinburgh, which was very unstable. You know, you have the Glorious Revolution, all of that happening, and in coming to very similar theological conclusions in these very different contexts.
Yeah, that's helpful. So for those, I imagine there's quite a few students who are interested in researching these things now, given the tumult that's gone over the last 10, 15 years in our own context, particularly Western anyway. If you were to tell them, study X, Y, Z, what areas are most fertile, or maybe what areas are also most needed to think about for the health of the church?
Yeah, very good. That's a good question. Of course, one thing that I want to highlight is the unique identity of the church, what the church is called to do. And this is what I very much appreciate from Dr. Van Drunen, is in terms of highlighting the unique calling that the church has in terms of ministering word and sacrament, and that very unique identity that the church has, very different from what we are called to do as citizens, you know, within this earthly realm. So that would be, you know, one thing that this study I hope highlights and certainly want to maintain is the uniqueness of the church, what the church is called to do, the mission of the church, and then also the role of the authorities within the church. What are their roles? What are they called to do? How do they represent the authority of Christ? And how do they do that properly? So, you know, in terms of staying in their lane, what they're called to do, even in the context, in class we had a lot of fun. Of course, we're considering this post-COVID, so how did the church wrestle with various you know, restrictions from the government, lots of different questions. Where's the line in terms of obedience and then, you know, obedience to God, and this is what God has called us to do, or obedience to the government, his representative authority in terms of the state. There's lots of fun areas to investigate, lots of different case studies that you can apply that to, but to be very solid in our principles for that and then to apply it well. I mean, you know, this has created so much division and turmoil, questions within the church. And so if we begin with, I think if we need to begin with proper definitions, very grounded within God's word, be so sure in that, you know, once we then come to a case that tests our principles, we're much more well-founded, right, when these very concrete applications come up.
Okay, now I want to think about pastors or ministers or just any lay member who is serving and helping to love their church. What are some possible recommended resources you might have for them? I know you've mentioned the source of division that this has been over the last 4, 8, 10, 12 plus years. So things that can help equip people to think critically and well about this topic, that can develop the right sort of sensibilities and related things like that.
Yeah, different resources. I don't have like a number one resource that pops in my mind. You know, I think Van Drunen has done, like I said, good systematic work to this. He's written, was his latest work, Politics After Christendom. That's a very helpful resource. I believe that was in 2020. So that's helpful. And then, you know, contrast it, put it side by side with, you know, work by Stephen Wolfe. Others, so really wrestle through these particular questions. I have not myself really gone into the area of political theology. That's kind of not my forte. I tried as much as possible to stay in the historical theology, but I mean, I find it interesting and fascinating. But it's not exactly my forte.
Yeah, no, that totally makes sense. So the last question I want to ask is, you're at Puritan right now, and you all have a great PhD program. Do you supervise PhD students? And if you do, are there particular areas that you're most interested in supervising students in?
Sure, yeah. Yes, I do. I actually just had, we just had graduation, you know, a couple days ago, and I was able to see my first student go through, so that was really exciting for me. Again, my area would be historical theology. I would love to oversee dissertations in that area, particularly continental stuff. There are others on our faculty who deal with non-continental or English material. That's not especially my area, but anything continental. I love systematic theology, covenant theology, anything along those lines. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, this has been great. So, Dr. Beakey, thank you for taking the time to talk with us about the duplex regnum and things related to it. Thanks for
taken the curveballs that I like to pitch to all of our historians and taking it like a champ. Sometimes people, when I ask them, they're historians, I'm like, what do you think about this? They're like, I don't want to answer that. So, right. Like, I get it, but it's still fun.
Gotta try to stay as objective as possible.
Right? Yeah, that's right. So thanks for doing this. This has been a lot of fun. Everybody who's been listening, you go check out his work. Go check out Puritan if you're not familiar. I think their seminary is just awesome. The work that they're doing there is unique and is flexible for ministers who are in their local congregations and just don't have the ability to leave, but can still get the nurturing and the educational opportunities that, I mean, nothing will replace residential. But what Puritan does is, as in my mind, as close to residential as you can get without moving. So. Yeah. Yeah. Treat you like a normal student. You get to be engaged with everybody else in class. I think it's fabulous. So,
go ahead. I just might add, you know, what you also started with, this blend of both the academic and the pastoral, right? That really is the heart of our seminary. I hope with my work as well, that we want to be rigorously academic, you know, in terms of producing quality work, quality students. But then also students that have a heart, a passion for God, for learning and following God, right? Wanting to serve God well. So really our motto might be, is unwritten motto is head, heart, hand, right? And so, you know, informing your head with robust knowledge, but an inflamed heart that wants to follow God, and with hands that are ready to serve God's people in His church.
Yeah, and I'll, my own personal testimony, I took a course with Dr. Beakey, so maybe I'm biased, but I think everything he said is exactly right. Even the student body, it was just very clear to me that these people actually love Jesus, but they actually, they're doing the rigorous sort of theology that I desire to do. So the blend of both was evident in the students. It's evident in the education that you receive. I know Cody Float, one of my friends, he's in the PhD track for Old Testament at Puritan, and he raves about Puritan all the time. So, personal experience, go check it out as a resource, because I think they're doing it the right way, and I think you'll definitely benefit from it personally, pastorally, all the things. It's highly recommended. So, everybody's been tuning in. Thanks for checking it out. This is the London Lyceum. We are the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet, and we'll talk to you guys soon.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.